Call the meeting of the House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, please take your seats. And there is a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 30th, 2019?
So moved.
Okay. And so we have Representative Wolgamott moves approval of the minutes for January 30th, 2019. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for January 30th, 2019 are approved. So I want to thank all of our testifiers for coming today. We have some from Greater Minnesota who traveled a ways today, so I hope that I'm going to encourage us to stay on schedule so that we can respect all of our testifiers who have come so that we can get it all in. So today we have allotted about 35 minutes here to have the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities and the PACER Center testify today. The Minnesota Council on Disabilities was created in 1973 and works to serve Minnesotans with disabilities through development of effective policy, training, technical resources, and collaborations with people and private stakeholders. PACER was established in 1977 by parents of children with disabilities dedicated to educating other parents and improving the lives of children with disabilities throughout Minnesota. Today, PACER offers more than 30 programs for parents, students, professionals, and other parent organizations. With us is Joan Wilshire, the Executive Director of Minnesota Council on Disability, Dr. Nancy Fitzsimmons from Minnesota State Mankato, and Barb Zepke, the Director of PACER's National Parent Center. Welcome to the committee. And who would like to proceed with their testimony?
I will start.
Okay, Ms. Wilshire.
Mm-hmm. Well, good afternoon, Chair and committee members. As the Chair stated, I am Joan Wilshire, the Executive Director of the Council on Disability. And as she mentioned, yes, last year we celebrated 45 years as a state agency. So it's quite an accomplishment. We're still here, going strong. We basically exist, as we were created 45 years ago, as an advisory agency. And that is to advise the governor, state legislature, yes, all you folks, state agencies, and the public regarding disability issues. And our disability issues are broad. We also maintain close relationships, you know, with the disability community and other disability organizations. As with the staff of under 8 people, it's hard to know everything. So, which is why today I bring you some guests with us to talk about some important issues here relating to education, higher education, and people with disabilities. When I have 17 council members that I report to, we're a little bit different kind of a board and council. And with me today is one of my council members, Nancy Fitzsimmons, down to the right here. And she is a professor at University of Minnesota Mankato. And she will start off the conversation first. Go ahead.
Okay, Ms. Fitzsimmons, or Professor Fitzsimmons, did I have that correct?
Yeah, Fitzsimmons,
okay, thank you, and welcome to our committee, and thank you for driving in today. It was a challenge.
Well, halfway here, I was like, what am I doing? So, thank you for 10 minutes. but, yes, it was a little bit. Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I did this because I think it's that important to be here. So I really appreciate the opportunity that Joan had to include me in this. So my name is Nancy Fitzsimmons, and I'm a professor of social work at Minnesota State University of Mankato. I'm a council member representing Region 9, and my entire 30-plus career has involved working with people with disabilities in a variety of settings and capacities. I've been at MSU Mankato for 18 years, and prior to that, I worked at the University of Illinois at Chicago for 8 years. I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of what we know about the experiences of people with disabilities on college and university campuses. I don't think I have to tell you the benefits and the necessities of attaining a post-secondary degree. What we do know is that while 39.1% of Minnesotans aged 21 to 64 have a bachelor's degree or higher, Only 16.3% of Minnesotans with disabilities have a bachelor's degree or higher. Students with disabilities are as diverse as any group of students by age, gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and by condition that contributes to disability. There is no one definition of disability, and so we need to think that students with disabilities are not an identical and homogeneous group that can be understood in any singular way. A video posted on the homepage of the National Center for College Students with Disabilities begins with these words: "Even though at times it may feel like it, you are certainly not the only college student with a disability. A testament to how alone some students with disabilities can feel on college campuses." The most current statistics available from the National Center for Education Statistics report: 11% of undergraduate students have a disability. 21% of undergraduate students who are veterans have a disability. 5% of postbaccalaureate students have a disability. What might these numbers look like in Minnesota? In the fall of 2018, there were approximately 128,000 students enrolled at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and approximately 66,000 students at University of Minnesota campuses. This is my math. I hope it's right. Using the NCES statistics, we can estimate that upwards of 31,000 students with disabilities are attending our public colleges and universities in Minnesota. Using the average annual in-state public tuition rate at four-year institutions of $9,178, that amounts to an estimated $248,518,000 of revenue generated from students with disabilities at public colleges and universities alone. Getting a true picture of the numbers of students with disabilities enrolled in post-secondary institutions can be challenging. First, the data collected nationally and on other surveys relies on students' willingness to report, and some students choose not to disclose. Second, data generated by college or university disability service offices only represent students with disabilities who seek out services and are willing to self-disclose. One of the challenges students with disabilities encounter is going from our secondary education system, which is very structured, adult-directed, and supervised, and a very supervised learning environment, to an unstructured, student-directed, post-secondary learning environment. College students with disabilities must learn their rights and responsibilities under a new law, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and to navigate their campus disability services system. Students must initiate the request for reasonable accommodation. In order to successfully navigate, students must be able to self-advocate, a skill that many may be ill-prepared to effectively perform. The primary way that campuses support students with disabilities is through the use of accommodations coordinated by campus disability service offices. Not all students with disabilities who would benefit from accommodation in the physical or virtual classroom choose to seek accommodations. So to get a reasonable accommodation, you must disclose, and you must provide medical documentation to support your claim of disability. Students with invisible disabilities must make a conscious decision whether they wish to disclose they have a disability. And there's some evidence to suggest that students with learning disabilities and behavioral or mental health related conditions are less likely to disclose. The reasons for not seeking support through campus services include they want to try to succeed on their own. The stigma associated with disability, not wanting to be treated differently, burdensome procedures, questioning being disabled enough, and concerns about future ramifications, both within the institution and beyond. The way that our system works is that we wait for students to seek the supports and services that could help them to be successful. It means that students who would otherwise be successful from the onset experience unnecessary hardship, oftentimes dropping out before they earn their degree. Furthermore, and I know this as a faculty member and many of my colleagues, just because a plan for reasonable accommodation is made, it does not mean that it will be implemented in a way that best meets the needs of students. The National Center for College Students with Disabilities in their report on campus climate wrote, "Schools are legally mandated to make sure faculty and staff understand that students with disabilities need accommodation and how to provide them. This does not mean it is happening effectively at all schools." Reasonable accommodation is made on an individual-by-individual basis of as an alternative to what is considered the norm. Universal design, considering the needs of diverse learners when something is being created, would best meet the needs of all students with disabilities and convey a message that they are truly welcomed and valued. This brings me to the overarching finding of the climate survey. Many campuses do not address disability as part of diversity and the campus climate environment. Even after addressing physical and structural barriers, the campus environment may be inhospitable for students, faculty, and staff with disabilities due to ableist attitudes about disability, as well as curricular, programmatic, and policy barriers. And furthermore, our campuses tend to over-rely on disability service offices to take the sole responsibility for disability matters, rather than having an institutional response involving multiple departments, offices, and individuals. To the best of my knowledge, there is no national system to track the graduation rates of students in higher education. The overall, and I cite a study in here, the overall completion of any post-secondary education program was 38% for young adults with disabilities compared to 51% for young adults without disabilities, and that's a statistically significant difference. Clearly, we can do better. We need to ensure that all people with disabilities have an opportunity to pursue secondary education, that our campuses are ready and willing to provide an educational learning environment that supports all learners, and that all learners graduate with a degree that will set them up for success in life. And I've identified in here from that campus climate report strategies to improve campus climate for students with disabilities, and I don't know that time allows me to go through all those, but I will highlight one of them. A final recommendation is to support the formation of DREAM chapters and affiliates on campus. DREAM stands for Disability Rights, Education, Activism, and Mentoring, and is a national organization for and by college students with disabilities. And I think we have a video that we're going to show. So my last pitch was going to be, if you do one thing in response to my testimony, watch this video, to hear directly from students with disabilities about their needs, experiences, and expectations. Then follow up with a hearing to hear directly from college students with disabilities in Minnesota about their experiences and what they need to succeed. Thank you for the opportunity for me to speak with you today. And if we can trigger the video.
I think that college students with disabilities get the messages that maybe they shouldn't be at college,
or that they can't do the work.
But it's not true.
People don't get it. They don't understand disability.
And they don't understand how ableist colleges can be.
One student told me she just has little disabilities, so she didn't want to ask for services or complain.
And in class, you know, they talk about race, and they talk about gender, and they talk about religion.
I'm on campus with like 30,000 other people, and I know there has to be other students with disabilities. But it's like we're invisible, and it's hard to find each other.
DREAM is a national group for college students with disabilities, run by college students with disabilities.
We're supported through the federally funded National Center for College Students with Disabilities.
DREAM stands for
Disability
Rights,
Education,
Activism.
We know college students with disabilities don't always get the messages they need, so we're here to give them to you.
Your college is lucky to have you.
Your accommodations and services? Yeah, those are rights, not special help.
Go ahead and ask for what you need.
11% of undergrads and 8% of graduate students have disabilities.
So if your dorm has 150 people, at least 15 of them have disabilities. Even if you can't see them, they're there.
You're never alone.
There are other students out there.
You just need to reach out.
There will always be barriers and people that don't get it. That's not a problem with you.
That's a problem with barriers and people not getting it.
The best way to deal with ableism is to realize you're dealing with it.
Some days are going to be hard, but you can get through this.
Get involved too. Study abroad. Get an internship. Organize students. Or find a new hobby.
Create the college experience that you want.
You're so damn awesome, go kick some ass.
And when you graduate, just think about your career and how ready you'll be.
You're going to make a difference.
Dream. By students, for students. Come join us.
The second speaker here is Barb Zemke, and she's co-director of PACER's National Parent Center on Transition and Employment, and has been on staff at PACER as an advocate also at PACER for 17 years. She's a proud parent of a young adult son with an intellectual and developmental disabilities. Barb.
And thank you and welcome to our committee, Ms. Zemke.
Thank you. I appreciate the interest. I think that the students spoke so eloquently, and we really are all about making sure that we support the success of every young person in Minnesota, and that they all have the opportunities they need to pursue those dreams and succeed. And in my current role at PACER Center, I work primarily with families and students and their families who are transitioning from high school into post-secondary education and employment. And we take phone calls, emails, we give individual support, we provide publications in family-friendly ways. We have workshops, for instance, off to college, what you need to know before you go, about the very kinds of issues that Professor Fitzsimmons so eloquently talked about, self-advocacy, changes in laws, all of those kinds of things. And so today I want to give you just a little bit of a taste of what some of those issues are that we're dealing with, and maybe some thoughts around how we all can work together to better support those students and their future success. One thing that we do at PACER is we are a national partner around the area of family engagement. We really support high expectations and family engagement as key components for the success of children and youth with disabilities. And as a partner, we're a partner in the National Coordinating Center called Think College, which is it's funded in part through the Higher Ed Opportunity Act of 2008, which defined inclusive post-secondary education for students with intellectual and developmental disabilities for the first time, also allocated the use of federal aid for programs that met their comprehensive transition program requirements, and then established this center to support and develop and expand quality programs for those students for whom this is a whole paradigm shift. Not going to take a long time talking about it, but I just want to say in my almost 30 years in the field, it's the biggest game changer I've seen for individuals with intellectual disabilities. On a personal note, my son had the opportunity to attend one of the two metro area programs. He was at Beyond Limits. There's two residential programs in Minnesota, and it was totally transformed his opportunities in life. And so we're really supportive of the programs that we currently have, but there's 260 programs nationwide. In many states, there are multiple programs as part of the state college and university system, as well as community colleges. And as a almost lifelonger Minnesotan, I'd like to see us do better in the expansion and support of those programs. And any way that PACER can help through our connection as a national partner, I wanted to mention that it's a whole other piece of what we're going to talk about. The vast majority of students with disabilities are not those with intellectual disabilities. They're those with the hidden disabilities of ADHD, learning disabilities, autism spectrum disorders, especially in what we used to call Asperger's, end of it, mental health disabilities. I know there was a recent report from the University of Minnesota that cited a percentage like in the 30% of individuals with mental health disabilities. The calls that we get from families about struggles that they're having in post-secondary education are by and large from those students with hidden disabilities. One statistic I read was that about 25% of students with learning disabilities disclose a disability at the post-secondary level, and that although the numbers that go into college are not that discrepant from the general population, the amount that graduate within 4 years is way less. So we really work around helping both the student and the family come to terms with what's this change, this huge transition. What we find is that most of them are not adequately prepared while they're still in high school. So at Pacer, we do a lot around the high school years of knowing what you need to know before you get there. Unfortunately, we get the calls that are, my son, you know, it's now second semester. We didn't realize we were supposed to ask for accommodations. He didn't ask for accommodations. He's failing. And they find out this can't be retroactive. Just to put a little bit of face on it, this last week I talked to a parent and then the young adult as well. They can only talk, the parents can only talk to us with their young adult's permission. And this young person had a learning disability and some mental health concerns, but she had worked so hard for 2 years to get through the coursework that was required to enter a certain medically related program. And she was an A student as far as coursework. She could do everything, but they had a time test to lay out the equipment for a procedure. And there was no wiggle room. You had to do that within 4 minutes, even though there wasn't clarity on the industry standards for that. Anyway, they couldn't believe that she was being dismissed from the program because of this one element. And so we had this whole conversation about the appeal process or how you could do this better. But that just illustrates some of the concerns. One is that, and I think Professor Fitzsimmons referred to this as well, but professors we hear of, instructors, adjunct faculty, or maybe you have a TA teaching in a class, assistant teaching, or you have a student with a disability out in a school setting, and the process for accommodations and implementing them is not clear enough. The guidelines are not clear enough. So we sometimes hear from families, we did go disclose, we did, the student says, got approved accommodations, but the professor's saying, I treat all students equal. I'm not going to do that. So these are some of the issues that need more support. Guidelines, clarity, higher expectations of everyone working together to support these students. One of the big issues that we deal with as well is around the use of technology and when students, for instance, students who are blind and need Braille or tactile graphics, or other students who need alternate formats, often there isn't a good process for getting that soon enough, that information, the syllabi, the required text, that information in order to provide them in the formats that they need. And so I know from my work on the State Services for the Blind, the State Rehab Council, one of the concerns is that there are certain colleges blind students kind of know if you go there, they're set up for that. And then there's other colleges that aren't, even though they might be the better fit for the student. So some standardization of what is it that we're asking colleges to provide, and what are those supports? The other issue is around, there are students with executive function disorders that they could do the academic work, but they need some supports in addition to that, a whole group of students. And there are colleges that do more than the baseline, but they usually come with a price tag for those additional services, so a tier two level of supports or a tier three. So we're not giving equal opportunity to students who don't have the means maybe to attend a private school or a school that is, you know, specifically focused on students with learning disabilities. So, you know, we really support the equal opportunity with more generally required supports, especially the first year, the first semester of school. This is when we're losing a lot of students with disabilities, is after that first year. If we could figure out a way to get creative with some additional supports and services for those students in those areas where, if it, with just that little bit of help, they would have the opportunity to pursue their dreams. Really, the college wins, and we all win when we support students. The employment outcomes for those students with intellectual disabilities post-graduation is almost double what they are for students without the opportunity to go to a college program. And so together, I think that we could put our heads together and get a little bit more creative, somewhat random system of what we do in post-secondary education around students with disabilities could benefit from some real support and guidance from the rest of us as we work together. So if PACER can at all support, help, you have questions, all of our services for families are free in Minnesota, so we encourage you to tap into that resource if we can be of help and collaborate together to make kids' dreams come true. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Did you have any further comments from Will?
No, I just wanted to say thanks again for allowing us to come in. And this is one of the things that the council does. We kind of a conduit. We figure out what's needed. If it's not totally our expertise, and we bring in the people that do know what that particular topic might be. So you're all welcome to utilize us. We're a state agency, and we're here to be a resource to all of you as legislators. So thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you. We have some questions, and Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just curious about some of the accommodations and the technological advances that we've had so that do you have supplies of, like, the directional mics and the, you know, something like this you could plug it into, and then it will do the sign language translation of a ongoing lecture that so that someone can, I guess, check out? Or, you know, if you got a supply of those type of items, how would they be able to get those to utilize?
So Professor Simmons.
Thank you. Everything happens, at least on our campus and most campuses, through the Office of Disability Services. And one of the differences between what happens in through K through 12 is that the students who may have an IEP, it's the responsibility of the district to provide whatever adaptive equipment or devices or such that's needed. In higher education, post-secondary education, it's not. So the university itself isn't responsible for providing students with whatever the necessary adaptive equipment might be. They might support the student in trying to identify what that technology might look like or what those tools might look like. But there isn't a responsibility for them to provide that. I can say that, and this is just anecdotally in my own personal experience, I've never had a student who, I mean, most of the students aren't coming with a sort of sophisticated technology to support their education. But it isn't the responsibility of the university under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Madam Chair, I thought we had testifiers who were part of an organization associated with the state that supplied services and assistance. So I was trying to determine whether the organization had access to resources so that families can come and you've got some equipment that they could utilize for college, and then also maybe if they had training for faculty and some of the university people so they could understand how, you know, sometimes you have to have certain seating, maybe there are acoustic effects that help, you know, all sorts of things that will assist the university and the instructors and staff to be able to understand how to be compatible and implement and be a partner in this activity. And that's, I guess, the aim of the query.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Wilshire?
Yep. Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Palm, state agency that or state group that works on technology would be the STAR program out of the Department of Administration. And they've got a small lab over in the Department of Administration that anyone can access to utilize and try some of the equipment, and they can get in equipment too and perhaps try out some of the things that you're speaking of, and that's available for anybody. I think it's a very underutilized program that we have with the state, and then they can get you connected to how to get the resources, perhaps even how to get funded, because there's Equip-A-Life program that helps with the funding of larger devices and so forth, and I believe
Okay, Ms. Zemke.
Thank you. It's such an excellent question, and it's a part of my little prepared speech that I left out, and that is the importance of assistive technology and universal design learning elements and the adoption of those. And I would say that one thing I want you to be aware of is Pacer Center has the National Simon Technology Center, and a lot of the work we do is helping students understand what is available that can help them self-accommodate, so to speak. And we do free consultations. We have a lending library. It's used across the state, and it's a rich resource. And there are some obligations of, you know, the college to provide access, so access has to be provided. But the way that it has to be provided is not a slam dunk that it's the best technology. We have some things at Pacer where a deaf person, for instance, can go into a doctor's office, hand them an iPad, they have an iPad, they're able to communicate without needing to use sign language, you know, through so there's some wonderful innovations, and we do need to really ramp up education as a whole. Even K-12 is behind the curve in most cases on assistive technology and so we really need to ramp that up for student success. I appreciate the question and the concern. So,
Professor Fitzsimmons.
I can just sort of address from how this works at the university level. And I would really encourage you to really take a look at, like, what kinds of resources are we investing across, you know, the Minnesota State system and the University of Minnesota system in particular, in terms of supporting disability services. So we, you know, we have a small office, and I can't tell you specifically how many staff work in that office, but I'd be surprised if it was more than a dozen. And so the process is the student is to go to and request and work with them on what the accommodation is. As a faculty member, I get a piece of paper that's sent to me through intercampus mail. It's a three-sheeted one where, you know, I sign off, and basically what it says is this is what the student's accommodation needs are, and then I arrange to meet with the student to talk about that, what those accommodations are, and then we sign off, and that's my obligation sort of to provide that. That's, for the most part, that's what the process looks like. And so it's really then left up to the individual faculty member to make sure that they comply with whatever that accommodation is. And if it isn't working, and I don't mean to disparage, I'm not saying that faculty members aren't doing this, but if things aren't working for a student, that it's the student's responsibility then to work with their faculty member to try to get them to make the accommodation. And if that isn't working, then it's the student's responsibility to go back to the Office of Disability Services and to request some guidance and some assistance. So it's really very much a student-directed process. And I think that's where some of this comes in terms of the need to be a self-advocate and to really be able to advocate for yourself. And for some people, that's challenging to do because you're concerned about grades and how what the ramifications might be if you go back and talk to the Office of Disability Services to say that my professor isn't supporting this accommodation. So I really do think we need to sort of look at how much resources we're really providing. The offices are campus-wide, and I think that was one of the issues that was addressed in that campus climate survey, which is we seem to sort of make the responsibility for supporting students with disabilities the role of a very small office on large campuses, and they really don't have a lot of power and position to do a lot to really transform or change institutions so that they really are welcoming and supportive of students with disabilities, not just in accommodation, but just in terms of how the system is designed and created for them, not in response to what their needs are, but actually that their system's in place to make it welcoming for them once they arrive on that campus.
Thank you. I'm going to call Mary Hartnett down to add her to this conversation. She is Mary Hartnett is with the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And so I would like to have her provide. And could have Paige pull up another chair, please? That would be great. And yes. She's going to provide some testimony, too. And if our members have questions, that would be good. So Oh, did you have a quick follow-up, Representative Baum?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I know that the big problem is this is the interface between ending high school and beginning, you know, that transition to college. And I'm not sure if this is the appropriate committee or we could do one that hits both committees, but I think that it needs to be sub-level setting. Anyone that has an IEP in high school should have this information provided and then the appropriate contacts so that they start out entering in. And maybe staff later could look at that. I'm not sure if we need enabling language in some bill, but I think that probably could alleviate some of the digging your hole before you discover that you have options.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Quam. And I would add 504s in that, too, students that have a 504 plan. I actually have experiences with people in my life, mm-hmm. and these services are not known oftentimes when people enter college. And it, like you say, it's found out too later, and there's a hole dug. So go ahead, Mary Hartnett.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We advocate for and work with the 20% of Minnesotans that have hearing loss in the state, everyone from birth to seniors. We're very fortunate. I was just asked to come to this hearing, and I would have had my Director of Education Collaboration and Advancement, who left the University of Minnesota after 17 years in teaching the Deaf and Hard of Hearing program there, to come to work with us, because we actually are very fortunate in that we have 50 stakeholders who have started the collaborative plan outcomes plan for children and youth who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing. So with our and Representative Lilly asked that I come today because he just agreed to chief author a bill and Representative Daniels, and I'll explain that part later. But the 50 stakeholders look at how to improve outcomes for kids. We have three work groups, and we just finished a study, and I don't have copies for the committee, but we just finished a study from Wilder Foundation, who did a comprehensive look at an environmental scan of what do we have, what are the barriers, and how can we overcome them. And we're very fortunate that we got legislation passed in 2009 that required that data on kids that are deaf and hard of hearing be desegregated, that we split out that data. And since that time, we've been able, and then we asked the Department of Ed to give us a report on the outcomes and recommendations and how we could improve those outcomes. And then we started to link into our civilian staffers with the state longitudinal education data system. So we are now able, and we're extracting the data, and we just got it, we're able to look from birth, because we do newborn hearing screening at birth, to employment, and looking at what are those points of intervention where we can provide the changes that need to be make recommended policy changes, or where can we make investments. And so we're fortunate that we're able to track our kids. Some of the problems that we've seen are the lack of skilled teachers. There's not a blind visually impaired program in the state. We have shortages, and Representative Lilly has offered to chief author that bill, and Representative Daniel supports that bill, and so that's why I've been invited to come here. But there's so many other pieces that I'll just weigh in here with my colleagues, that the assistive technology that was readily available, hearing aids that were available until they were 18, once they become 19, they're on their own. If they don't have hearing aid coverage, they struggle in the classroom. Those aren't available. The assistive technology, they're on their own to get that, and they have to self-advocate for those or identify other resources. So there's so much more that the 50 stakeholders are doing, and we have a transition age group that is working specifically on strategies and identifying them. We have a transition guide for students that stakeholders develop. These 50 organizations are working together. We have the Department of Ed, the Department of Health, State Services of the Blind, and Vocational Rehabilitation Services, regional low-incidence facilitators, the University of Minnesota. We have parent advocacy groups. We have deaf advocacy groups. We have hard-of-hearing advocacy groups. We have everybody providing every lens to try to improve outcomes. So that's what we're trying to do, and if anybody has any questions, we've copied the plan. And I recommend that my Director of Education and Advancement come, because she's much more articulate than I am and can make the case and provide much more information. So, Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Lilly, for reaching out to Ms. Hartnett today and inviting her. I'm glad you were able to provide some testimony.
Thank you.
So, go ahead.
Madam Chair, one other comment. We had a work group that was on employment and overcoming barriers in employment, and one of the recommendations was that we had in place 20 years ago was a specialist who worked with deaf and hard of hearing students who was dedicated to going around to all of the university campuses and providing the training on what it takes to support a student who is deaf and hard of hearing. When you think of the cost of college tuition and having one person dedicated to go around the state to make sure that people have that skill set and are able to explain what the accommodations are. Only 2% of students are deaf and hard of hearing within the state education system, and when they go into higher ed, though hearing loss doubles with every decade of life. So the older you become, the more likely are you to have a hearing loss. And hearing loss is actually the most prevalent disability that you can identify at birth. So a lot of disabilities, you can't identify at birth. But that as we go through this process, it's just important that we're providing all these supports when they're, as my colleagues here said, when they're young. But when they get into college, there are very few dedicated resources to ensure that they have a level playing field, that they have that success. Thank you.
Okay, well, we don't have any more questions. So thank you very much for being here and for your role in helping all of our students be successful. And we hope we can be partners with you and in helping in whatever way we can as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so our next presentation is from the Department of Education on looking at the different types of post-secondary enrollment options in 10th, 11th, and 12th grade students to earn college credit while still in high school through the enrollment and successful completion of college-level courses. Roughly in Minnesota, 10,000 students annually participate in a PSEO program. We have with us here today Mary Barry, the High School to Post-Secondary Initiative Supervisor with the Minnesota Department of Education, and Caitlin Snyder, the Department of Government Relations at the department. Welcome to the committee. Come on up. And we may not cover all the different options for students today. I'm hoping that we get through as many of them as possible, but this is an overview more of the options, which sometimes gets called PSEO. PSEO sometimes is just referred to as a specific option, as there's other options like AP, IB, all those kinds of things. So hopefully we'll cover as many of those as possible today. And if members have interest in other areas that weren't covered as in depth, we will look to see if we can provide that opportunity later on. So welcome to our committee. We appreciate you being here today. And who would I have a third testifier that I don't have down. So the first if you could name your name, state your name of who is, I don't have listed.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Caitlin Snyder, Government Relations, Minnesota Department of Education, and we were very excited to present in front of your committee for the very first time, and so you get a third excited Minnesota Department of Education employee with us today. Beth Barsness will be launching our presentation.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Beth Barsness.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. Thank you for having us here today. As you stated before, we are here to cover post-secondary enrollment options. I am the high school specialist at the Department of Education, so I deal a lot with the dual credit programs that you mentioned, PSEO, concurrent enrollment, advanced placement, and international baccalaureate programs. But today for this presentation, we have prepared a PowerPoint about PSEO in general and the concurrent enrollment programs. So those are covered in one statute, 124D09. And with me today, too, is Dr. Mary Barry, who will be doing part of the presentation kind of midway through when we talk about who is participating in these programs. So first of all, I covered this already. The main two that we're talking about are post-secondary enrollment options and concurrent enrollment. So these are situations where high school students are either taking college courses on a college campus or in their high school for what we call dual credit. So they receive both high school credit and college credit when they successfully complete the course. The big benefit to students and families are that these options are completely tuition-free to the student, and they're earning college credit as they are earning their high school diploma. Some other benefits to students and families are that they're taking, involved in rigorous courses and really preparing for what it's like to be on a college campus in the future and career, learning time management, stronger writing skills. Admissions offices usually are looking for these on high school transcripts. It also gives students the chance to enter college with a advanced standing as well. And there's opportunity for students to explore more subjects or maybe courses that aren't offered in their high school. Okay, so this is where we get kind of confusing. But by and large, when we're talking about PSEO courses, PSEO is taught by a college professor on a college campus or online. So students are actually leaving their high school building to go to college just like other college students and sitting in class and taking these courses. The credits that these students are taking must be counted towards graduation requirements back to their high school. This program, or PSEO, the traditional model where they're going to college campuses, is the most biggest access for students in Minnesota. It's open to public school students and non-public school students, including homeschool, for 11th and 12th graders. And then there are some instances where 10th graders and even 9th graders are able to access this program. And this, it gets a little nuanced with the way it's funded and who is teaching it. So those are the differences that we'll be covering after this. And also feel free to ask any questions, too, as I'm going forward. So again, I refer to traditional PSEO by usually a student going onto the college campus, but also how it's funded. So traditionally, PSEO is funded by general education revenue. It's goes from the, instead of going to the school building or the district, it gets paid directly by MDE to the post-secondary institution. So the district or the charter school does not receive any of the general education funds when the student is not in their seat in their building. If a student is pursuing PSEO full-time, meaning they're not taking any high school courses in their building, the district or charter still retains 12% of their average daily membership. And then MDE pays the post-secondary institution at a rate of, this year, $207 per credit. And there is no cap on funding, meaning that the general education money just goes to the post-secondary institution instead. And then there's this other little subset of PSEO called Courses According to Agreements, which has a little bit different payment method, meaning that the district and the charter retains the ADM for the student, and then they will pay the post-secondary institution directly for that tuition. This is decided on by the partnership between the district and the post-secondary institution. We at MDE do not have any information or data on these partnerships, like who has a partnership, for example, and how many students are involved in PSEO by this method. This is also referred to as PSEO by contract. Another kind of mode or way of accessing PSEO is by what we call concurrent enrollment courses. And these are also under the PSEO statute. These courses are taught by high school teachers or post-secondary faculty members in the high school. So again, it's a post-secondary course, but it's taught in the high school. So the student would not leave to go to the college campus, and then the money is then retained at the school building. This is available to 11th and 12th grade public school students, and some 9th and 10th grade public school students are also able to access these courses in some under some situations and circumstances that is spelled out in statute. Sometimes the concurrent enrollment is referred to by kind of some branded names like College in the School, which is the U of M program, or College Now, which is I'm not sure who the post-secondary institution is for that, but they're it's called many things, but this is generally what people are referring to when they refer to it by those names. As I stated before, concurrent enrollment funding, the district or charter retains the ADM for the student, and then the state does provide concurrent enrollment aid to districts to offset the cost of offering the course. There's a $4 million appropriation that is available for districts. But when it all works out in the end, schools are generally getting $54, or they did in FY17, $54 per credit for these students that are in these courses. The statute says up to $150, but once all the courses are taken and enrolled, this is the payment that ends up happening. And this just kind of gives you, now that you know all the terms, I threw a lot out there. This is kind of what PSEO has looked like through the years. I think Minnesota was the first state to have PSEO. It started in 1985, and just access has been increasing for different groups of students throughout the years, as well as concurrent enrollment aid appropriation was increased in 2016. And then one thing I wanted to point out is that in 2014, it was added in that students from state alternative programs, state-approved alternative programs, can also access PSEO. So this was a new area for them, for a new group of students to kind of use these or access these courses.
Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. And this is Mary Berry. Okay, welcome to the committee.
You pronounced it correctly the first time, but nobody ever does, so I was impressed.
This was my first time. I didn't say it already.
Oh, you said, I'm sure you said Mary Barry, but I mean, that just sounds so, nobody.
And that's the way.
No, everybody calls me Mary Berry, so.
And it's supposed to be Barry. I got it right the first time?
Okay. You did. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having us today, and thank you for the Early Middle College program. It's like Beth said, it's our newest PSEO program, and it's for students in our state-approved alternative programs, students who have traditionally not been able to take advantage of the traditional PSEO programs. And one of the advantages of this for our alternative school students is that students can take developmental classes. That's not allowed in a traditional PSEO program. So we all know that students in our alternative programs are just as capable as any other student. They just haven't had the academic opportunities. So this is a way for them to also access opportunities on a college campus, but taking classes that are geared towards their current academic level as we move them on up to be able to be successful in those classes. And another difference in this program is that students have to choose a specific pathway. The law states that the partnership between the post-secondary institution and the district will specify a distinct pathway to a degree or a certificate that students have to choose, and it's laid out for them and they follow that. It requires a very strong collaboration between the post-secondary institution and the district to be able to scaffold the extra supports that students might need. So overall, and these figures are taken from our rigorous course-taking report that states that we got from FY17, We had 9,939 total students, of which 7,322 were public school students, and that represents about 8% of the high school students in the state of Minnesota. But those students earned 158,000 college credits, an average of 16 per student, and the state spent about $31.5 million on PSEO. So this next slide, we wanted to give you an idea about the students that are in these programs. We have a slide here which gives you the number of special education students, English learners, and students on free and reduced lunch, and also gender. And you can see it's there are many more female students that are taking the traditional PSEO student program than male students. When we look at our program participation by ethnicity, about 75.5% of the students taking this, the advantage of these classes are white students, and the remainder are students of color. We have approximately 10% black, 5.5% Hispanic, 8% Asian Pacific Islanders, and then about 1.6% Native American. It's somewhat close to the overall percentages that we have in the state, although the percentage of white students that we have in these programs is slightly higher than the state average. So we go back over time. So if you go all the way back to FY11 to FY17, we've seen a significant increase, even though it's not where we want it to be, in the participation of students of color. We're at approximately 24% students of color. But I'd also like to point out that as our increase of students in poverty and students in color has increased, our scores have not declined. The next slide will show you the PSEO reimbursement. And over time, we have definitely increased the amount of money that we're spending on PSEO. But if you notice in the last few years, it's going down. It doesn't mean that overall PSEO participation is going down, just the PSEO participation that the state directly pays for. We know there's an increase out there in districts and charter schools contracting directly with the post-secondary institution. It appears to be a better financial arrangement for both parties, but we only really hear about that anecdotally because we do not participate in those contracts and they're not reported to us. So in the in that program, which is the concurrent enrollment program, we have far more students participating in that. I can't see it over there because I'm a little bit blind. About 32,000 public school students, and they took 74,000 college courses and earned 255,527 college credits. And like Beth said, we give $54 per student per credit that the districts are offering these classes. Here's our participation again, gender and special populations for the concurrent enrollment classes. And it's fine. Don't you love it when people are presenting and they read to you exactly what's on the slide? So I was kind of trying not to do that a little bit. Our concurrent enrollment participation, I don't know why, but there's a really much higher percentage of white students in concurrent enrollment classes than students of color. So that's that slide. And then we also have the concurrent enrollment participation trends on students of color. And even though we've seen a large increase in participation since FY11, the percentage of students of color, when you compare it to it overall in our state, is quite low.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Barsness. Yep, thank you. So we just wanted to point out also who the post-secondary institutions are that are participating. In traditional PSEO, we have 62 Minnesota colleges and universities, and this includes campuses from all systems. So Minnesota State, the U of M, and some private colleges that offer PSEO. We did reference the rigorous course-taking report to the legislature. That's where we pulled most of this information from.
And I wasn't sure if you had it in front of you, but if you want to download it from the Minnesota Department of Education website, and you wanted to see who all of the post-secondary institutions are, you would find it in Appendix F. So I wanted to note that for you if you wanted to look, which is on page 59. And then to compare concurrent enrollment, the concurrent enrollment program, the participating post-secondary institutions, there are 38 campuses that offer courses in partnership with different high schools throughout the state. And that list, so that you can see, is also an appendix H in the same report. So that shows you the enrollment by institution and the total number of credits by institution. So it's kind of interesting data to look at. It's just pages and pages long, so I didn't want to make some slides with all that information. And then last, if you want to see which districts and high schools are participating, or I'm sorry, it's by district, there is also an appendix in that report about who is participating and how many courses and credit counts from each district, if you wanted to look. So there's 319 districts that offer concurrent enrollment to students. And that's all for our presentation, so we'd invite questions if you have some.
Sure. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is we have three members on the questions. And members can ask more questions, but before we move to other people after those questions, I'm going to invite up Mark Grant to provide some testimony as well so he can be in this conversation as well. So, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'm a huge fan of PSEO, concurrent enrollment, and everything you've presented, because I was a benefactor of those programs when I was in high school. So I just have a couple questions. I was in my first term, I was actually working to make some updates to the language and some changes. So I guess the first question I have is, when is the last time there have been statutory changes? I know you discussed that there was a new program that you created, but how about actual statutory changes? And my motivation for the question is, I'm very much interested in any changes that you might have or recommendations to improve the program and working with you on that.
Who would like to respond to that question?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Eider.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, the last change that I'm aware of happening is in the 2016 or 2017 session. There was a provision to allow Grow Your Own grants to be offered through concurrent enrollment introduction to teaching, and that has a link to the PSEO statute. That is a carve-out for a particular program. It doesn't necessarily change the overall statute.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative?
I do, Madam Chair. Actually, I have a series of questions here, and I appreciate that. So I definitely, again, please connect with me. I'd like to get some feedback on additional suggestions that you might have. Over this past summer, well, I guess it would have been 2018, and over the summer, it was Anoka Tech had an event where multiple legislators were there, both House members and Senate. And in that discussion, they were suggesting that technical schools are disproportionately not represented by some of the PSEO or concurrent enrollment classes because of the nature that they're more specific in the trades or technical degrees naturally, and it doesn't fit in some of the requirements that the high schools have, and therefore students are steering away from the technical schools because, again, the courses wouldn't fit the requirements for the high school credits. So the question is, are you working on any initiatives or programs to, you know, get students the opportunity for technical degrees? Because, as we see in the headlines, the trades and technical schools or technical degree programs are, there's a huge demand.
Madam Chair.
It is Bari.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Actually, there's a provision in the law for our 10th grade students is specifically for them to take a CTE course. And I know that we're all part of the Office of College and Career Success, And I actually just said it wrong. It's career and college success, because we are trying to focus on CTE and those things, those career pathways for students. I think what you may be referring to is the provision in the law that says the classes taken at the post-secondary must fulfill a graduation requirement. And so that could be a little tricky in that it might be difficult to say, you know, how does welding fulfill a graduation requirement? But we do have electives that are part of our graduation requirements, and schools are able to look at the scope and sequence of the courses that are being offered and determine which graduation requirements or which portions of graduation requirements they would be able to fulfill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, yeah, that's you hit on it. That's exactly what I was referring to. It's the graduation requirements. Some of the more specialized technical courses in the technical schools that would lead towards the degrees or careers that are in demand now and for the foreseeable future don't fit into what the high schools are looking for, and therefore students are dissuaded from taking them because, they don't fulfill those requirements. So I think there's an opportunity for us to explore how we might be able to work with high schools to allow students those opportunities. And then I'll just throw the last two questions out there so you don't have to come back to me. You mentioned the reimbursement for the different programs. Are those fixed in statute? Are they adjusting for, you know, over the years? And then the next question would be, or last question is, when I was a high school student, I don't recall how I became aware of the program. So what efforts is the department putting out there to make sure students' parents are aware that they can take advantage of these opportunities? Because I wasn't aware until I was a senior, and I would have loved, or at least I didn't participate until I was a senior, and I know that I definitely would have been interested as a junior.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Snyder.
Thank you. So the first question, there's a capped appropriation for concurrent enrollment at $4 million a year. The statute says that it can go up to 150 per student per credit, but there are so many schools offering so many concurrent enrollment classes that we're seeing that the actual amount of funding going out is almost two-thirds less than that.
And take the second one. Okay, Ms. Barsness.
And I just thank you. I just blanked on what the question was. I was ready to answer. It's in the statute that schools need to counsel the students and let their families know that these opportunities exist and what the risks and benefits are of enrolling in these programs. So it's at least in statute that the schools must be doing this, and then we work to prepare training for counselors and for schools to know exactly the ins and outs of the program, and to, you know, make sure that we have updated materials on our websites, and we do a lot of support for families. I feel like way more than 10,000 students are participating in this program because I get these phone calls every day. So we are really working with schools to give out the correct information. And as, you know, the statute gets updated from time to time, there's a lot of kind of misinformation that floats around out there for maybe somebody who has done this for a really long time but hasn't been, you know, told what currently is the change, if that makes sense.
Okay. We're going to go to Representative Gomez and Runbeck, and then we 5 minutes, we're going to have Mr. Grant testify, and then we're going to pick up with Representative Poppy. Okay, so Representative Gomez.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just Googled the answer to my question, which was that developmental classes are what we sometimes call, like, remedial classes, in case anyone else was wondering. But thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. That was an interesting point that they made. I did not know about that. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I should have Googled mine, too, because it's pretty basic. But I really have never heard a presentation on PSEO. So basically, then, these students that are on the college campuses, do they just attend classes as any other student would, or is there special, you know, breakouts for them or any special way that they are, you know, treated on the campuses?
They
go ahead, Ms. Barsness.
Thank you.
Ms. Barsness, right?
Yes. Thanks, Madam Chair. These students are just accessing courses like regular college students. So I think a lot of times the professors don't even know who from in their class is a high school student. There are supports for early middle college students. Those programs, really, we stress that supports need to be put in place from both sides within that partnership between the high school and the college. But there are supports on the college campus and at the high school that these students in traditional PSEO can access. So they kind of have a little bit of both worlds.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually work as a counselor at Riverland Community College. So I work with PSEO students, so I can answer a couple of questions here. One of the students are taught and treated the same as all college students. I know that they're PSEO because I'm a counselor working with students, but faculty member may or may not know. So if a student doesn't necessarily reveal that they're a high school student, they may not know that. So they're under the same expectations and requirements as any college student. Some students may have difficulty doing a career technical program because if they are required to be a high school student and they do have requirements and expectations to do English and history and math and science and perhaps civics in the future, they may then be restricted to taking only liberal arts related classes at the college because most of our CTE programs are programs. And so it's difficult for a student to take an intro to welding course potentially if it's a full welding program. So I think that the colleges, and Mr. Grant's going to be able to provide some additional information, but I believe that the colleges are trying to accommodate students and allow them to take classes and kind of break some out so that they can get introductory courses to career tech programs without having to fulfill the entire program. And another comment just to make is that just in the recent past have the colleges been allowed to talk more about PSEO as an option. Prior to that, actually, there was a restriction to do that. So I think, Representative Lucero, you maybe found out about it and became aware of it to participate, but it has been a little bit more difficult between the high school. So I appreciate that we're having this conversation in higher ed because we need to have a little bit more of a collaborative effort when it comes to our high school students becoming college students. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And we're going to go to Representative Mr. Grant. Yeah, right. And then take question from Representative Cleavorn then.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome
thank
to
you.
The committee, Mr.
Thank
Grant.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Mark Grant, and I teach at Dakota County Technical College, and I currently do the governmental relations work for Minnesota State College faculty. That is the two-year faculty.
And we'd like them to. We'd like all our testifiers
don't
to stay
go
there.
Anywhere.
Not the hot seat yet.
If I have to stay here, so do you. Those
go
are the
ahead.
Right.
I was trying to give you more room.
No, that's quite all right. I'm the youngest of five. I'm very used to being at the corner of the table. I just wanted to, and I appreciate your time, I just want to spend a minute. As far as I know, this is the first time that this committee has seen a presentation about PSEO, and it was very difficult for me to see that happen and not just take a few minutes of your time because I think it's indicative of what PSEO has become. I'm not here to dispute anything that has been said by any stretch of the imagination, but I think PSEO offerings have evolved over the course of their tenure. I think initially the primary motivation for pursuing PSEO classes on behalf of high school students was primarily academic. The model was always intended to be students who had kind of plateaued out in their high school somehow. They needed an additional challenge. They needed a course that wasn't offered in their high school. They needed more than their high school was able to offer them. What we're seeing now is the primary motivation is undoubtedly financial. That PSEO is seen as a budget savings. It is part of people's plan to pay for college as they take out their pen and paper and they try to figure out where all the money is going to come from. PSEO and credit savings is absolutely part of that formula. That's the fundamental change that we see in PSEO, is the motivation for people being in it. I teach college classes. I see a lot of PSEO students. Some unequivocally fit the mold that it was originally intended. They are high-achieving high school students. Some, not quite as much. If you asked if they are treated the same, they are treated absolutely the same, much to the chagrin of their parents, as a matter of fact. As soon as they cross the threshold of the college, I get to treat them like an adult, which means the Family and Education Rights Privacy Act applies to them. I can't talk to their parents about their progress without their expressed written permission. So parents hate that, by the way.
Yeah.
I kind of like it, but anyhow. So, what we see is because the primary motivation is motivational, is financial, and then that cost savings, of course, is available to everybody, regardless of how that cost savings may be needed in their own personal family financial plan. Because it's available to everybody, what we also see is oftentimes the students who may need that cost savings the most are the students who aren't represented in taking PSEO. They're the ones who may not have access to a vehicle to leave the high school during the course of the day and attend a high school or attend a college class. They don't have the $10 that their folks gave them for lunch on the college campus on the day that they're on that college campus. And so we at the two-year system, because we overwhelmingly meet this need, the vast majority of these PSEO credits happen either with or through the two-year college faculty. We're very, very focused on the students that we see every day, the students that tend to need it most. And so the fact that PSEO has been woven into the higher ed conversation, again, there's that cooperation there. That conversation absolutely should happen. But we would contend that that further investment in higher education may help return PSEO to its original intent and not necessarily seen as a cost-saving measure. Specifically, within the umbrella of PSEO, concurrent enrollment is one facet of PSEO that we do find structurally problematic. It's a far longer conversation than we have time for today with it snowing and all, and I would be happy to come back and talk about that if that's something that you'd like to talk about. But concurrent enrollment is one area that we seem to have a significant concern with. So with that, I will take any questions or yield the rest of my time.
Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My question is really to the point that you just raised. I just wanted to make sure I understood correctly. In PSEO, transportation is not provided. It does fall upon the family members to make sure transportation is available.
That's my understanding, yes.
Madam Chair.
Oh,
if you want to talk about it.
Ms. Thank you.
PSEO reimbursement for transportation is available to students from low-income families. But from my understanding, it is kind of a difficult process. Obviously, you have to have the $10 to pay up front for your how you're going to get to the campus or your bus pass or whatever, and then you have to request to be reimbursed for that. So there is money for those students, but it is totally their responsibility to get to and from the campus on their own.
Madam Chair, the only thing I would add is my recollection is that the definition of low income in that statute is particularly low income. It's lower than the free and reduced price lunch requirement, but we can provide that information to the committee if that's of interest.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add one third option for a motivation for taking PSEO. So absolutely, those that are students that are excelling and have plateaued, those that want to save money, but there's a third, which was my incentive at the time anyway, which was to get a jump start on my degree in order to overlap, obviously, the completion of high school with the at least the first year of a two-year degree. So very important to getting out early and then starting the workforce.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if we could back up again about, because I didn't totally understand how this all played out, but we talked about the formulating cap on funding, and then also the difference between $54 per credit versus $150 per credit. So those are some of the numbers that I caught. But could you go over again the context of what we're talking about for those things? So the cap is on what, and it's the number of students that are limited, or how much a system is getting reimbursed, and can you explain that section again, please? Thank you.
Ms. Murray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pryor, the $4 million and the $54 reimbursement is only for those concurrent enrollment classes, and those are classes that are taught in the high school by high school faculty in conjunction with a college for the college credit. And the reason we only do $54 is because we have a $4 million pot when we spend it all, but we need to know how much we have to divide that by. In terms of the traditional PSEO, there's no cap on that funding. And what I mean by that is PSEO statute requires a high school student to drop one class, at least one at the high school, but then they can take as many college-level courses as the college agrees for them to and as they want to. And so in that sense, we don't really have a cap on our PSEO funding, if that makes sense. So you can take five classes at the traditional high school and four classes at the college.
And if I can
Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair Bernardi. So talking about concurrent enrollment then and the $4 million cap, so you distribute the funds because it is limited. And so does that mean that school districts are limited? Instead of getting up to $150, a school district gets $54 or to pay? And so, okay.
Okay, so I want to make – I had a visitor from College Board today, and they talked about advanced placement. And I don't know if this fits in the conversation that Mr. Grant wanted to talk with us about further, and I know there's only 5 minutes left, but we do have 5 minutes. In a committee, that's a lot of time. And what they pointed out to me today, that in Minnesota, we are, I don't know how they exactly articulated it, but we're like losing some ground on where we fall in the country as far as students taking advanced placement. It's not growing, and what they had said, as I understand what they told me, is more students are taking concurrent enrollment because they don't have to take the AP class to prove they learned the information and parents are wanting their kids to do concurrent enrollment. Do you have any comments about that, Mr. Grant? And does that relate anything to the comments that you wanted to make to us? Or would you like to take 4 to 5 minutes to share with us, or am I putting you on the spot?
No, I will not take the rest of the time. Thank you, Representative Bernardi. That is my understanding as well, is that from a sheer streamlined obstacle standpoint, concurrent enrollment represents just the a path of least resistance, but it's simply easier, and particularly at a local institution, transferability seems and application in of those credits in their in the college that they hope to attend to seems to, I don't mean no guarantee, but they seem to be very comfortable in that as well. That doesn't speak in that in part speaks to the growth of concurrent enrollment, that we find some structural aspects of concurrent enrollment that as it grows, it becomes increasingly structurally unsound. The phrase "House of Cards" was recently used in an attempt to describe the amount of credits that college campuses are recognizing through concurrent enrollment and the sustainability and viability of that. I really didn't want to derail this at all, so I don't have those numbers. I would very much like to come back and have that conversation if that's something that you guys would like. Yes, my understanding with the relation between AP and concurrent is in keeping with yours.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Cleavorn.
I would like to thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to ask I can't remember exactly, so if you could help me clarify this. When a student takes AP classes, does the student family pay the AP test exam? And with concurrent enrollment, there's not a fee. Is that correct?
Ms. Barry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Claiborne. The department has funds to cover a part of the cost of the AP exam. For free and reduced lunch students, there will be no cost to the exam. And for students who are not free and reduced, the exam cost is either like $45 or $54, depending on if the district takes the rebate that is offered. But there's no cost for the exam for free and reduced lunch students because the state is able to cover a portion of that cost.
Thank you.
Okay, so Representative Quam.
Quickly, because of the issue with concurrent enrollment and some pushing of qualification and requirements on that, there was discussion about the accrediting body, and we probably don't have the time now, but it'd be nice to have that information updating what the status is with the accrediting body and the issue that presented itself.
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, yeah, I would be happy to make those numbers available to you. That's certainly something that we're watching really closely. Thank you.
Okay. Any other final statements by our testifiers? No? Well, thank you very much for being here today and presenting to our committee. We appreciate that. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.